You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program, For Land's Sake. I'm your host, Bill Kite, and today our guest is Gwen Garcelon, a consultant on regenerative... I knew I was going to have trouble with that word.
Regenerative.
That's the one thing. Thank you. Thank you, Gwen. Regenerative strategies. Gwen, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in regeneration.
Well, I worked in the movement to end hunger and poverty for a long time, and it was during those years that Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth came out, and even before then I was starting to see the writing on the wall of where climate was going, and just decided I really wanted to start working in that arena. I'd been supporting leaders and groups of advocates, and just really felt the calling. And my kids were small, and I wanted to stop traveling so much. And so I started working on the local food system. And I think food system work is the gateway drug. I mean, I think it's why you see, you know, in the Transition Town movement, which is a movement of communities wanting to rebuild themselves in ways that will be resilient and in right relationship with the land. And a lot of the transition work starts at the local food system level, because that's just a very foundational way that we can both connect to the land in the places where we live and figure out how to sustain ourselves wherever we find ourselves.
I know you have a strong relationship with the land, and has this deepened your relationship with it in developing a more kinship relationship with
absolutely.
The land?
Absolutely. You know, I think it was really when I, well, there have been so many different pivotal moments of deepening my relationship with the land. But one that's been really joyful is having a garden and doing the daily work of tending to a small piece of land. It's in a community garden behind Third Street, and I've had it for about 5 years now. And going there daily to water and weed and tend and have my hands in the soil, it's a way that helps me understand the weather and the climate and the temperature and all of the things that go into producing food.
And the insects and the weeds.
Yeah. And I've noticed how much it calms me, how much it has helped my mental health to have that direct connection. So that's been big.
Yeah, my wife has a plot over at the Good Seed Garden near the orchard, and she's taking care of that, and it's a lot of work, but it's great to have fresh food, isn't it?
Oh, it's the best. It really is.
Are you working with local food systems now here in Carbondale?
Well, I have been for a number of years. It was really in 2011 that a friend and I formally sort of started a food policy council and started to look at what it would take to create, you know, a collective of people who wanted to put some effort into projects that would benefit our local food system. And so we did a lot of research over the years and a food hub assessment, and been a lot of really good projects that have happened through that work.
Have you had to really unlearn our consumptive, extractive behavior in relationship with the land?
I made a conscious choice in, I think it was really when I about the time that I had my kids, I realized I did not want to be part of a culture that first of all, would take me away from my kids in order to make money to have stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I really, that was a real turning point in the choices that I made on a day-to-day basis. My housing, what I did for work. And it's been a whole process of stepping away from the predominant paradigm of our culture of consumption and extraction, and seeing if I can live on the smallest footprint I can and give back as much as I can, and you know, continue to downsize what I need,
right,
in order to be happy. And what I've noticed is that, oh, you've got to really, for yourself, redefine your measures of success. Because the main things, you know, the size of our house and, you know, our credentials and blah, 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 everything that we have, when you're defining your success by other things, you really have to prop yourself up, because you're not getting those affirmations from external sources. So you have to find in yourself, you know, the joy that comes with alignment with your values. And that's what I've really found is what gives me the greatest sense of success, is the more I can align my life with my values.
It's hard to do, I think, for all of us, because finding that right relationship between what we believe in, what we say we believe in, and what we talk about and nature is complicated.
It is.
And I don't know, sometimes I figure when I try to measure success, I don't measure up to my own success that I'd like to see. So that's a hard one, I think. For
it's people. A lifelong, you know, it's a day-to-day having a lot of compassion for yourself, but also holding yourself to a higher standard, you know.
So how do you do that every day? I mean, that's, you know, it's, you just have to question yourself a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a life of a lot of self-reflection. And that's definitely something I took on at an early age in my spiritual path. And I think something that we've, you know, in thinking about, you know, what we talk about today, I realize how much having a spiritual connection to the land is something that we've lost as a predominant culture. We revere it, you know, those of us who revere indigenous cultures, we revere their spiritual connection to the land, and yet it feels foreign to us because we weren't enculturated that way. We weren't brought up that way, most of us. And it's something I've really had to build for myself. I lost my father at an early age, and so kind of lost my whole family. So I started a spiritual path, mainly meditation-based, yoga-based, in my 20s. And it became a very central part of the way I walked in the world. And I'm continuing to see that as this part of the evolutionary step that we're being asked to make as a culture, if we okay. want to continue on as a species on this planet. It's going to take rebuilding a spiritual connection to the land. It's just no doubt about it. It's just non-negotiable.
I'll never forget Northern Ute Elder Clifford Duncan, I worked with a lot, said that you can take the Utes out of the land, but you can't take the land out of the Utes.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of relationship that you can aim for, but it, when you, like you say, when it's not been part of your culture, it's not easy.
Yeah, it really does. I've found that it requires daily chunks of time outside in the woods. And
sure.
And I've had to do that for myself in order to maintain that kind of relationship.
You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. And our guest today is Gwen Garcelon, and I'm talking about regeneration with her. So let's continue that. How does what you do fit into the emergence of bioregionalism
or the bioregional movement?
Yeah. I didn't even realize that what I was feeling was something that was really emerging globally, which has been referred to as the bioregional movement, which is a way of organizing regeneration of the land by watersheds, food sheds, areas of land with natural land boundaries or, you know, watershed boundaries. And we can see we've gotten so far away from that in the way we govern ourselves. We're governed politically, both random boundaries on the land that really make no sense
exactly.
When you look at the land.
Right.
If we organized ourselves in relationship to the land, we would naturally see our communities relating to watersheds and food sheds and, you know, natural land barriers. It's certainly the way indigenous cultures organize themselves. And so this is a movement that's happening with learning being shared between bioregions globally. Rita Marsh of the Center for Human Flourishing and I have been participating in something called the Design School for Regenerating Earth. We've been a part of that for a couple of years now, organized by Joe Brewer, who wrote a book on bioregionalism. And it's been fascinating to talk with other people who are out there in their places, you know, all over the world, doing what they can and learning their way forward to create new kinds of organizing mechanisms. So these might be funding mechanisms for funding regenerative projects. And
right.
And creating those mechanisms that don't necessarily exist. I mean, there's lots of different places you can go and get grants for different things, but they're not necessarily organized in a place-based way. And that have the specific goal of large-scale regeneration of the land and water. So it's building those mechanisms. One thing that is coming to the fore is the idea of bioregional learning centers. And those can look like a lot of different things. We have pieces of them here, and they exist in different forms in different places. They're often places where you can go to get information about the land and water. So I know, like, Roaring Fork Conservancy has a great new building where you can go and learn about the rivers and our water resources. So a bioregional learning center might weave that center in with local food system information that might exist, say, at the Farm Collaborative, and might weave it into different projects that are going on different places, knowing the farmers and ranchers who are trying new regenerative projects on their land. So a place that would kind of archive and weave these larger regenerative efforts so that we can start to look for areas of collaboration and projects that are emerging that might be priorities for funding. There have been biodiversity studies that have been done, and weaving those in so that it all exists in one place where there's a person or a group of people keeping their eye on the ball of all of these types of projects and efforts.
Okay.
Making them more available to people, more outreach to the public.
You answered my question. I was going to ask, how do these bioregionalism centers work? So.
Yeah. And it's very place-based, because every community, every watershed, every food shed has a really different set of socioeconomic things going on, and, you know, different things that may already exist. So it's a matter of kind of understanding what's emerging as an opportunity here. There's a group of people that have organized themselves around the monastery in Snowmass.
Correct.
That that big, very precious piece of land that's now for sale. And and people in the Snowmass Caucus and folks and ranchers who live in that area have formed a group called the Friends of the Monastery.
Oh, okay.
And very interested in keeping that land conserved. It's precious habitat. It's very precious to the water cycle up there. It's precious ag land. That's an opportunity for people to come together. And it could be a bioregional learning center.
Boy, it'd make a great one. Those buildings just seem like they fit there, don't they?
And it has the spiritual component. And, you know, these are the things that we're realizing need to be part of these kinds of efforts.
I know you're conducting retreats and where you're guiding people into a new way of relating to the land. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because they're very interesting.
Yeah, that grew out of several years that I spent consulting for one of the large architectural firms in the country and building a leadership team that was really leading the regenerative design efforts for that firm. And what I was realizing was that when we'd get together for a retreat, it felt natural to me to have people spend some time alone on the land. And this probably came from my own spiritual work and my own the value that I received from solo time on the land. But I just knew that this group would not be able to be the creative and generative force that they were being tasked with being without that being sourced, without their leadership being sourced from their relationship with the land. So I built into all the retreats that we did during those years solo time on the land, and it was miraculous, really. And people, whenever we would get together to design the retreat, they said, oh, we've got to have the solo time on the land. And so when that when my time with that group ended, I wanted to keep, I just knew that there were a lot of people, a lot of environmentalists who spend their lives working in service to the land, but their own personal felt relationship was really lacking. And so I thought, maybe I can create a container where people can start to reclaim that for themselves, because it's a very natural part of each of us.
It is, isn't it?
And when you get people out on the land, they feel it, and it rebirths itself in them. and I've found that there are, specific ways to create this experience that make it possible for people to drop in more quickly. To open themselves to the listening and the real two-way communication that happens when you're deeply related to the land. And I think that's what leaders really need right now in order to navigate their way through the challenges they're being faced with.
I had the opportunity to be part of the first first part of Outward Bound, going out away from the headquarters and doing just staying out in the land for a month. And part of that was 3 days of solo by yourself, no food or anything. You just you were there and you had to figure it out on your relationship with the land. It changed my life, basically.
How many times have we heard that, you know, from youth programs to adult programs, you know, when people have that really intentional and reflective time on the land?
And
it
intense.
Does change your life. Yeah, it is intense.
It's intense, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So tell us, if people would like to know more about these retreats, tell us how they could do that.
Yeah, they can go to my website. Okay. It's gwengarcelon.com. And whenever I will be doing the next one, likely in September of next year, and that will be locally based here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I may do one over the summer. But I really have loved doing something in the spring and the fall. So keep an eye out for those. I also may have a course starting in January that incorporates some of these pieces of the kind of leadership that we're going to need, really regenerative leadership. So that we're not burning ourselves out, because I see that a lot in this field of sustainability, environmentalism,
right.
Whatever. We're working in such an extreme context of uncertainty.
It's a good way to put it, extreme context of uncertainty.
That we've never seen before, that we've never experienced as human beings. And it takes a real intentional set of practices and choices to be able to maintain the kind of openness and creativity that we're going to need to bring to this work to create what's next, because it will certainly be unprecedented.
I think people have to be transformed from the way we think now, and it's sometimes hard to get people to listen to what you're trying to say until it becomes that aha moment, and then it becomes a part of them. And but seeing that connection to the land is not, you can't see it, you have to feel it. It has to be something that becomes real to you, doesn't it?
It's very felt. Yeah, like spirituality. I mean, I think that's why most people say, oh, my church is outside. You know, when I go out in the woods, I feel spiritual connection. And it's true. I mean, there's an actual energetic frequency called the Schumann resonance that we feel when we are on the earth. It's part of this earthing movement that's become part of the health care realm. But what we're realizing is that that's really needed as a regular practice in order for us to be in real service to the land, where what needs to happen is being sourced really from that relationship with the land.
I think this leads into our last few minutes of how do you see the future as you continue in the service and leadership role to the land? Is grief, anger, hope?
All of the above, okay. For sure. The thing that I've come to know about what's being called eco-grief now, it's a very different kind of grief than what when you lose a person or, you know, some other distinct thing in life. With eco grief, we kind of get back to a place of functionality after a big crisis or something, and then there's the next thing and the next thing,
right?
And the universe kind of keeps upping the ante with the intensity of these experiences, and what we know scientifically is that's what we can expect from these next several years, is that we've passed the point now where we can control what will unfold. Not to say that we don't have agency, and this is the difference. We've got to choose to show up and serve even when we can't see the results of our actions. And that's hard.
It is. It's true.
But that's what alignment with our values looks like. Something that we would do no matter what.
Okay.
And so no matter what the feedback is that we're getting, to give it our all and keep showing up amidst the anger and the frustration and the despair and, you know, the bargaining and all those pieces of grief that will keep happening, for us to get more comfortable with that landscape of emotions and not allow it to keep us from serving.
Yes, that's it is a calling in what you're trying to do, and what most people find in their life is most satisfying. It's most satisfactory to them is a calling, not a job or profession, but something that you have to do. And you're the one that has to do it. You can't look back and say, well, somebody else can do it.
Each of us is precious to this. Each of us has an evolutionary influence on the whole.
We do, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what quantum science has shown us, which is so profound, is that there is no small influence. It's all what every choice that we make, every thought that we have, mm-hmm. has an energetic influence on the unified field that we are all embedded in and a part of and influencing all the time.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. Thank you for all you do.
You've been listening to Katie and Kay's For Land's Sake. Join us next year on the second Monday of January, the 13th at 4:30, for Sarah Johnson of Wild Rose. She'll be with us. Tune in.